I will call the Senate Judiciary Committee. Oh, Senate, yeah, that's right. This is the Resources Committee. Sorry about that. Senate Resource Committee, my apologies. I'm the spare tire, you know. You know those little spare tires that everybody has, the little gritty things?
Donut.
Yeah, I'm the donut tire today in place for the real chairman of this committee. Today we have Senator Wilkowski, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Click Bishop, Senator John Coghill, who's acting chair. It's now looks like it's about 3:34. We have Ann helping us out here and Leah helping us out with the LIO. Today we have just one item, and that's the confirmation of hearings of Fate Putman and Dale Kelly for the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And the chairman gave me a little history to read, so I'm going to read that, and then I'll call you up here. It amended, we in Alaska amended our constitution in 1972, opening the door to limited participation in our common fisheries, which, by the way, is an anomaly in our constitution, for the purposes of resource conservation. And we have Senator Kevin Meyer with us.
Thank you.
So the purpose of the this was the resource conservation for our economy. So, and I'm not doing a very good job of reading this, am I? To prevent economic distress among fishermen, for those dependent upon them to for a livelihood, and to promote the efficient development of aquaculture in our state. So the Alaska Legislature passed a Limited Entry Act to implement the tenets of the Constitutional Amendment, and the Limited Entry Act is managed by the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, which these two commissioners will be here today on. So the memberships, the members in the public have a fact sheet for this commission which outlines their qualifications. Often we see attorneys as commissioners, but it's not required. This commission, however, is a quasi-judicial body, and it's all its decisions are appealable to the Superior Court. Current law assigns three seats to the commission with a quorum consisting of two members. And over the past 3 years, the Lawson Report and later the report from the Legislative Audit highlighted the staffing and meetings practices for review. So appointees, once confirmed, can only be removed for cause. And the commissioners meet regularly throughout the year, and their compensation is equal to a range 27, the equivalent of $100,000 a year as a base. Finally, the commission operations were derived wholly from fees and taxes assessed through the limited entry program, which I expect will be a part of the discussion today. So with that regard, with that background, I welcome to the table the two appointees from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Fate Putman and Dale Kelly. And I know I visited with Fate for a few minutes, but I missed the meeting with Dale. Sorry about that. So why don't we do this? Why don't you go with, both of you put yourself on the record and then go through your opening statement, why you would like to do this, what your background is, and why we can trust you to do this. So, Fate, why don't you introduce yourself first, and then we'll let Dale do her first testimony.
Great. Fate Putman for the record, and so they recognize my voice, and maybe Dale could say a couple words so you recognize her voice on the record.
Yep, and Dale, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and then give us your opening statement, the reason why you want to do this, and what you expect to be able to do.
Oh, you'd like me? Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Dale Kelly. I'm the designee commissioner for Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. I live in Juneau. I guess I had a little prepared statement. Would you like me to run
through
that?
Yeah, please do. Yeah, go ahead and go through your prepared statement, and then I'll have Fate do the same thing, and then we'll go into questions.
Great. Thank you. So while I wasn't fortunate enough to be born in Alaska like Fate was, my soul pretty much was. I've been here more than half my life. My route here was pretty circuitous. I grew up surfing, riding rodeo, and rock climbing in California. My academic training was ranged from fishery science to aquaculture to pharmacy to paramedicine. I worked as a pharmacy technician in three states, and one of my most unique responsibilities was preparing drug packs for the space shuttle. I worked in surgery and on ambulances in downtown Houston, which I think probably helped toughen me up for life as a commercial fishing deckhand. I've lived in the bush. I've been a fish culturist in Prince William Sound and Southeast. I've helped rebuild steam turbines in Haines and Fairbanks. And whenever time allows, I enjoy fishing on a troller out of Craig. I have no financial interest in a fishing business, and I'm not a permit holder. For the past 3 decades, I've been executive director of a commercial fishing organization representing fishermen who fish in state and federal waters for salmon, halibut, and other species. As a result, I've acquired extensive knowledge about fisheries and habitat conservation, resource management, and a wide array of state, federal, and international regulatory policies and laws. I'm a supporter of all forms of fishing and have worked on behalf of all fishermen my entire career. Among my industry duties, I served for 12 years as an Alaska commissioner on the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, which is a 5-state organization whose mission is conservation and sound utilization of West Coast fisheries resources. I'm a member of the Pacific Salmon Commission, which implements the U.S.-Canada Salmon Treaty, and I chair the U.S. advisors of the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission, which is a 5-country commission working to protect anadromous fish stocks through research and enforcement of high seas illegal fishing. Over the years, I've helped to start and manage a number of blended state and national industry groups and coalition where we've worked on issues of mutual concern. And I've been fortunate to serve on various other industry boards and legislative, gubernatorial, and congressional advisory panels. I'm familiar with the scope of work that CFEC tackles, and throughout my career, I both consulted with and worked with the commissioners and staff at CFEC. I believe it's important that commissioners have a solid understanding of the challenges confronting the seafood industry in general and the harvesting sector in particular. I welcome the new challenge and the opportunities for learning that a CFEC appointment offers, and hope that my knowledge and experience will be an asset to the Commission and the state's fishing communities. I think Commissioner Putnam and I bring a set of complementary skills to the table, and it seems to me we could be a good team for assessing the condition of CFEC as a mature organization heading into the future and implementing any needed change and charting a course for that future. There has been already, as I'm sure Commissioner Putman may highlight for you, a number of organizational and policy development projects already in progress. I applaud the work that he and staff have done to date, since I'm not even 2 weeks into the job. So we're in agreement on a lot of these new objectives, and we're working to develop plans to institute more. We've been following the lines. He's been following the lines of the 2 reports that were done, the Lawson report and the legislative audit. So see a lot of things that could be worked on there. And I appreciate the opportunity to share a bit of my background, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you. And what we'll do is we'll let Fate go through his opening statement, and then we'll just open it up for questions, and then we'll do rounds of questions. Fate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fate Putman. And I'm a designee for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. I was appointed December 1st to replace Ben Brown, a good friend of mine, who retired from the commission, resigned from the commission to take a different job. And so I was happy to take the opportunity to serve on the commission. Ben and Commissioner Twomley had been recruiting me for a couple of years to serve on this commission, so I'm happy to step forward now to take that role. I hadn't anticipated that Chairman Twomley was going to retire as well after 37 years of experience, but I am I'm learning something every day, and I'm learning about this commission. But let me just start with a little bit of my personal history. I was born in Fairbanks. My mother was a city planner. My dad was a plumber pipe fitter. My mom went off every day with a briefcase. My dad went off every day with wearing a tool belt. So I had a lot of fun with that growing up. We moved to Anchorage in 65 after the earthquake. My mom worked for ASHA, Alaska State Housing Authority, reconditioning communities that had been destroyed in the tsunami after the earthquake, including Valdez and Seward and other places. And then she became a city planner in Anchorage, worked on bike trails. She was known as the Bike Trail Lady of Anchorage. Very interesting. I learned about eminent domain and all those things as a little kid when my mom would have to go to court and grab property to make those contiguous bike trails. I also went to Stellar High School in Anchorage, one of the first students to go there, and West High School, graduated in 76. After that, I attended Linfield College in McMinnville, Oregon, ended up graduating from Western Washington University. My first legislative job was 39 years ago here in the Capitol building. I was an intern. I worked for Senator Pat Rohde, who's Judiciary Chair. In that job, I learned about Christmas treeing. When you find a title, it's broad enough to put something in, including the student internship program. We managed to wedge it into a bill, and that internship program is still in existence today. I returned during law school, worked in the Natural Resources section of the Attorney General's office in 83. I worked on natural resources like Dinkum Sands, Navigable Waterways, Mental Health Trust Lands, and also on salmon hatcheries, and CFEC was one of our topics that we looked at, and I was interested in it way back then. I think that's about 35 years ago. I've served as the manager of a commission before. I was the commission on the future of the permanent funds staff and manager of that commission. I worked for Red Boucher, who was chair of the State Affairs Committee back then, 1989. Serving also on that committee, Jan Fakes, Terry Martin, Denny Kelso, if you know who he is, Mark Langland of North Rim Bank, Hugh Malone, former commissioner and of the permanent fund and also a former legislator, Steve Frank out of Fairbanks, had quite an interesting group of people. We flew all around the state taking testimony about the permanent fund, which is always interesting, and I'm sure it's something you're struggling with today. That was looks like about 25 years ago. I was appointed to the Anchorage Municipal Planning and Zoning Commission in 1993 by then Mayor Tom Fink. Very happy with my service there. I really enjoyed that, particularly since my mother's history in city planning kind of prepared me for that. And then after that, I went to work as the legal counsel, political director, lobbyist, and assistant executive director for a large public employee union for about 20 years. I retired from that in 2015, became a contract lobbyist for the last couple of years, and now I've changed directions, radically you might say, to serve on this commission. I am no longer a lobbyist. I am doing this full-time. It is a full-time job. I thought maybe it wouldn't be when I started, but it turned out from day one that it is a full-time job. I'm learning more and more each day, and the more I learn, the more I realize I need to know. So let me just get a little bit of fishing history so you know my fishing history. In 1979, I was a salmon hand troller here in Southeast Alaska after my internship. After that, I was a longliner for halibut with my dad back in the 70s and 80s, and also deckhand for halibut in winter of 84 out of Homer. I was a cash buyer for my brother's fish company back in 1981, the Putnam Fish Company, that did end abruptly with my brother's passing, but from there I went on to law school. After law school, my family and I have maintained a fish site, a fish camp at the mouth of the Kisilov River for the last 20 years. We do it from the 15th of June to the 25th of June. I'd encourage every Alaskan to do this. It's your opportunity to catch 25 fish for your freezer and bring it home. And we have fed our family for years on that, and then we smoke all the fish, last year's fish, and get fresh fish, so it's great for us. I've never held a captain's license, and I've never held a limited entry permit, although I've deckhand. And I've covered my tenure, so I think I'll just stop there and see if you have any questions.
Thank you, and both of you, thank you. This is one resource that we want to do well at, and I was actually kind of surprised at the volume of permit exchanges that have to happen down through a year, it looks like there's quite a bit of movement on any given year between license and permits, right? So it keeps the staff pretty busy from the looks of it. And so just for me as a question to you, from the staff level to the commissioner level, what are the things that you have to do that the staff can't do? Just from your perspective, as you've seen that coming forward, because I know both of you are still fairly new at it, but at that commission level, you are going to be making decisions that the staff can't make. Can you give me an idea of what that breakdown is?
Sure. To begin with, the essential function of the commissioners is to act as an appellate court, kind of like a divorce court or a bankruptcy court, something along those lines. We are, in a sense, an appellate court because that the people that work for us, the adjudication section, adjudicates hearings and questions of that the licensing staff can't answer or deny because of the strict interpretation of regulations. But those regulations are variable depending on the conditions of the fishermen and what the circumstances are. So fishermen are always allowed the opportunity to appeal a decision to the hearing officers, the judicial officers. They make a ruling or recommendation to the commission, and then we review the rulings and make our final determination based on what we think the commission and the regulations should follow, and also the recommendations from the judicial section, the adjudication section. From there, these cases are appealed to the superior court. There have been hundreds of cases that have gone from this commission to the Superior Court. 70 cases have gone to the state Supreme Court. There's a huge body of law associated with this area of the fishing industry. And the reason I think that it was so controversial at the beginning was that the commission decided whether you got a transferable permit or a non-transferable permit. Obviously, a transferable permit is worth a lot of money, and a non-transferable permit is not, because you can't transfer it to another person. So those controversies have been worked through primarily. There's about 13 cases that are still pending before the commission. Some of those cases have fact patterns from 1975 that have not been resolved. I think that some of them are more difficult cases, and Commissioner Kelly and I have the opportunity to go through those 13 cases over the next year and see if we can resolve them. Our intent, of course, is to work them through the system. Since I've been there, since December 1st, we resolved 18 cases, two of which were remands from the Superior Court back to our commission. Those two cases we've settled. I can't speak specifically about the cases or the terms of the settlement, but we were able to resolve those cases through settlement, and they did not go beyond the Superior Court, and their interim use permit, which is something else I want to talk about, ended. So when an interim use permit is what every fisherman is allowed to have if they're appealing a case. So if they're appealing a case, they continue to fish under an interim use permit, even though they don't have a limited entry permit. And some of those people have been fishing up to 35 and 45 years on these interim use permits. So we are doing our best to see if we can resolve these cases and get those interim use permits that are there for these appeals resolved, so that so that the optimum number of fishers in a fishing area can be resolved. That's primarily what our concern is right now. If that answers some of your questions.
Thank you. Did you want to add anything, Ms. Kelly?
Obviously, Commissioner Putman's given me a pretty broad and extensive overview of what commissioners do. And I guess what I heard in your question had to do with how we interact, what we do with staff, and how. So I don't want to play the I'm new card too heavily, but I am new. And what I do when I'm new is I wander around, try to figure out what my job is. Yeah. So I've been going on a daily basis, picking a number of staff and wandering around, finding out what they do. And I'd like to learn how to do what they do. But also what I do for them. What is my job? What do they perceive my job to be? And I've gotten a variety of responses to that, but one is just they have particular questions because they are implementing these regulations, and sometimes they need a ruling on that. And as Fates pointed out, we've got very intricate law involved in limited entry commission. It's kind of one of those deals you pick a thread on a sweater and it can unravel if they're not careful. So I think there's a lot of oversight, it seems to me, and because of some questions we had recently in a staff meeting that maybe how they're implementing the regs, whether they're on track, whether they're going to, for instance, pull a permit. I mean, there are some cases where a permit won't be renewed. So it seems like there's a lot of give and take maybe between the commissioners if there's questions that arise, and just making sure that they're implementing the law properly. And aside from that, I think we direct a lot of the research as well, or if there's information that you need or industry needs, there's reports that go out. I think we're working on the annual report now, trying to figure out how to inform the public about exactly what it is the commission does and what we're responsible for. So I'm still learning, but I'm hoping that I can give you a better outlook on that with a little more time under my belt.
Sure, thank you. And I've got a few other questions, but I don't want to dominate other questions. Senator Van Hemel.
Thank you. Thank you both for your introductions. They were interesting just to hear your stories, so thank you for sharing. One of the questions that I have is I see that there are three at-large positions here on the Entry Commission. There's two that's filled and then one that's vacant at this point. Considering the amount of work that you've described, is what are your thoughts about keeping that vacant? Do you know of any person that's looking for this position, or that's a name is being floated, or what are your thoughts on that?
Maybe I could start. We have sort of decided, if possible, to run this commission with just two commissioners rather than the third commissioner, because right now we haven't limited any fisheries since 2004. So the jobs that are being done on a daily basis by the staff, we're monitoring that. We also have downsized staff so that there is no longer an executive director. So the commissioners will act as executive directors for the commission. And maybe Dale has other thought on that.
So as Fate said, we're obviously running with two, and the governor's only appointed two. So I guess from my perspective, I think there was a real wisdom to the Limited Entry Act being set up with three commissioners just for the decision-making process. We have three cases pending, significant cases, and I am, while I'm really committed to consensus, which we both are, it'll be interesting to see over time how that works. And I think one advantage of having the three and having just that option for the commissioners not to gridlock on something is it really protects the public and the state from having to go to the next level to court. I think the Limited Entry Commission offers several layers and kind of backstops and I think saves money and time for both parties in its current form. Hopefully we'll be able to get through it consensus and honor the governor, his two-person appointment at this point. To me, I consider it kind of a grand experiment. I also am not here, as I've told staff and myself, I'm not here to protect my job or anybody else's job. If it really seems like a commission can be run more streamlined without the third commissioner, or if we have other staff, you know, we can do it with the Trimmer staff. I think that I'm certainly committed to look at it with a fresh set of eyes and see what we think about that. Right now it's a little too early to tell.
So just looking at one of the lists here, it says in 2015 they issued 18,147 permit and 9,646 vessel license participations.
We have a great licensing staff.
That is a volume.
Maybe I could explain that a little bit for you. So there are open fisheries and limited fisheries in Alaska. We, of course, go out to the 200-mile limit to regulate fisheries into the federal waters, but the 3 miles for the state, 200 miles for the federal. If you are in a limited fishery, you receive a permit from the commission. If you're in an unlimited fishery that hasn't been limited, you also have to receive a permit to fish from the commission. So we permit every fisherman who's in those 200 miles offshore fisheries. And then we are also watching through optimum numbers to determine where there's a stress on a fishery. So you have the Board of Fish and you have the Commissioner of Fish and Game. The Board of Fish meets about once every 3 years to deal with fin fish, for example, or other types of fisheries. They rotate a cycle through. The Commissioner of Fish and Game can do an emergency closure on a fishery if there's stress on a fishery, if the biomass isn't there, or if the research hasn't been there to determine whether there is a bycatch that they can catch based upon sustainable yields. So as those two things interface with each other, the Commission watches those. We have a research section that tracks those decisions, and we may at some point determine that there is enough stress on a fishery, an open fishery, that it needs to be closed. And that will be the point where we will have our caseload will go up, because we'll go in there and we'll make these determinations on who has a history of fishing, who has a dependency on the fishery, and those are the parameters that we use to decide whether a person gets a transferable permit or a non-transferable. And then those decisions are, of course, what become controversial and end up in court, those decisions that we make. And, of course, like I said, 70 of them have gone to the state Supreme Court, including Carlson. So that's my response to that, if that helps.
Good point.
Question? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Putman.
Yes.
Thanks for coming, Ms. Dale, as well. I appreciate it. Tell me how the appeal process works at the commissioner level.
Sure. So the trials are held by adjudication section. We have, at one time, we had seven attorneys that worked in the adjudication section. Then we have paralegals that do some of the background work. There's sometimes two and three paralegals. So it was at 46-member commission at one time, employee-wise. We're now down to 13 employees. So the way that it works for us is if a trial happens and those adjudication officers, they take evidence, they put people under subpoena, they get confidential confidential information, including tax returns and other information from the witnesses and from the appellants. They then make a recommendation to the commission, but the final decision, of course, is in the hands of the commissioners. And as Commissioner Kelly said, we're going to try to handle these things on a consensus basis. There is a piece of legislation on the House side dealing with this particular point where you have two commissioners, and we that particular piece of legislation also allows, the in the absence of one of those two commissioners, for the commission still to function, because right now you have a two-member quorum requirement, and if one of those commissioners isn't there, then the commission doesn't exist anymore. So we're trying to change that to a two-commissioner situation that, that can function that way. If we get into a situation in the future where we have to limit a fishery, we may come back and recommend either hiring expert, like Chairman Twomley for all these years, who knows this business very well, or some other expert to help us get through the cases as we work through any new limited fishery in the future. And that's basically how the process works. Now, all those decisions that are made by the commissioners can be appealed, of course, to the Superior Court and then to the Supreme Court.
Right.
Yeah.
Similar to what I used to do at the Department of Labor on work.
Exactly.
On. Okay.
Yeah.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
So you two have to be 100%.
That is also an issue.
How's that going to work?
Okay. That very good question. Well, our intent is to, of course, always agree, you know, but when we don't agree, the ruling of the hearing officer, the adjudication section, becomes the ruling of the commission. If the two commissioners are split, then that is what the fishermen will appeal to the Superior Court.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and Senator Wilkowski is back with us. We just went ahead and opened it up for questions because I did not have anybody signed up for public testimony at this point, so we just jumped right into questions. Two things that, from my observation, first of all, I would be reluctant to agree with you on the two-member commission. That's be my natural. I would end up in that start. I would start off with that point. So as we go forward, I'm not too sure. I'll watch closely how you all do it for the rest of whatever life I'm here in the legislature. But I appreciate the fact that you want to try to be unanimous as much as you can. Two things that I noticed that I was not aware of that the commission had done. First of all, I didn't know that this was a pretty significant part of the Fisherman's Fund. That was news to me. And so can you tell me what portion? I see the numbers, but I don't know how that is proportionate.
Sure, that's and I turn to Dale after I give you a quick overview so that she can give, she actually has the numbers in front of her, and she's going to dig those out for us right now. The Fisherman Fund was started pre-statehood, as you know. It is designed as a type of workers' comp for injured fishermen. And it, of course, because a lot of fishermen couldn't afford insurance, they got injured on the job. So about 40% of the money that we collect, is that? I will defer to my co-commissioner to actually answer that, because she has, as you might have figured out, been involved with the CFEC for a long time and on the governor's task force to restructure the CFEC. So she has a pretty good handle on this, and we just discussed the Fisherman Fund before we came up here. We give on average about $400,000 a year to the Fisherman Fund. And I'll give you an example of where our money comes from so you understand where this comes from. It all comes from fishermen. There's the front-end fee if you have a fisherman's captain's license at the beginning of your fishing season. You have to have a card on you that has your name on it and your ID with you to be on the water. You also have to have a vessel license. Those all come from CFEC. We charge a small fee for that. And then at the end of a fishery, we charge 0.4%, roughly a half of a percent, of whatever money you make in the fishery based on your fish tickets, which are confidential and held by us in our records system for 45 years. It gives you an idea how long we hold stuff for 45 years. And we base that 0.4% on how much money you made as a fisherman in an open fishery. If you're in a closed fishery, it's 0.4% of the value of your permits. So we have economists that watch the values of permits, which go up and down based on sale prices, and that's how we base our fees at the back end. So this pot of money, about $8 million, I think it's 40% by law goes into the Fisherman's Fund, and Dale will correct me if I'm wrong, and then about $5 million goes to the Department of Fish and Game, and about $3.5 million is used by the commission to function. So of that $8 million, if my math is really off, but I'm not. I'm an attorney, not a mathematician. Maybe I can turn to Dale for the real numbers.
Do you have anything you want to add to that, Dale?
I think, and not without getting you into the weeds, so I think we'd be
good. The other thing that was a pleasant surprise to me that I didn't hear the last time we had an issue with this commission was how much money had been returned to Fish and Game. It looks like a total of $16 million, about $4.7 just last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Dale, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, actually, I just got an update on that today because since fiscal year 2012, there's been about $23 million that's gone to Fish and Game. Last year, it was about $5.6 million. So what I've noticed over the years, just outside looking in, is, and I think sometimes to the detriment of the commission, quite honestly, whenever times are tough and Fish and Game budget is getting restricted, they've really tightened their belts and put more money in to Fish and Game. And obviously, it's all the money's coming from fishermen. It's an appropriate secondary use to manage our resources with, and fishermen have long supported that. But, we also want the commission to have enough money to be dynamic and kind of ebb and flow with whatever work is in front of it. But they have put, seems like they've really been belt tightening and, for the good of the order, really helping to assist Fish and Game.
And I'll bring your attention to one case in particular, the Carlson case, which is a case that involved out-of-state. Are you familiar with this one? $37 million the state had to pay with interest to out-of-state fishermen who sued the state of Alaska because of the 3-to-1 margin that was being charged to out-of-state permit holders against in-state permit holders. And that the basis of the case, if that makes sense, the Carlson case went to Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't charge 3-to-1, but you can charge a little bit more. And so every 3 years we calculate the Carlson number, which is over and above what we charge in-state fishermen for their permits. If I got this correct, Dale, correct me if I'm wrong. And then that money is used to support fisheries enhancements, because if there is no studies in the field on a fishery resource, a bio-catch, a count at a fishing weir, all those things have to occur, because of that, if we don't have that information, the Commissioner of Fish and Game will err on the side of caution for sustainable yield and not open a fishery because they don't have the science to back up the opening. So they do need the funds, both from our collection and also from out-of-state fishermen, that they help pay for that. Those two things help pay for the Fish and Game doing that research.
So you have a research arm within the commission, plus whatever you can help with the Fish and Game, is what I take it. Or is it one and the same?
If I can explain, they have field researchers at Fish and Game. So a lot of people I know that have done this out in the field, they're on weirs and counting. You've heard of that. We don't go out in the field. We use the information that they collect to tell us what's going on in a fishery, what's the biomass, what's the sustainable yield, what do we expect, what kind of pressures in the fishery. And then we're also watching, like I said, Board of Fish and Commissioner of Fish and Games closures to determine whether there's a stress on a fishery or if there's a biomass enough to catch. But those decisions, whether to gear size and season openings, are all made by the Board of Fish to determine how the catch happens. And then the Commissioner of Fish and Games steps in if those three-year intervals, something's gone wrong.
Anything you want to add?
I guess what I would mention is that if we talk about our research staff, and one thing that Fade had brought up is one of our statutory charges is optimum numbers studies. When limited entry first occurred, they maximized the number of permits that went out just to make sure that folks that were truly dependent weren't left out. And I think the initial legislature was looking at the fact that they wanted to make sure that we'd go back and reel that back in so that we didn't harm resources down the road. Whether or not they should all be done or we need optimum numbers on everything kind of remains to be seen. But if we are to start clicking through the fisheries and doing those optimum number studies, you should be aware we only have 2 people in research right now. And one report that was done, the optimum number study that was done on the Bristol Bay fishery, there were 3 researchers spent 4 years, not the whole 4 years, but a considerable part of 4 years, and thousands of dollars to issue just one optimum numbers study. So that's why, if we've got a demand and we need to be doing something, I think that making sure that this this commission has enough resources, and in both monetary and personnel, is going to be essential to do the job properly.
Right, well taken. The other thing that I noticed, and I'm dominating the time, but I did not know that there were 68 unique fisheries from some of the fact sheet that I was looking at.
That's mm-hmm. just the limited fisheries, not the ones that may ultimately be limited.
Mm-hmm. So. That, right.
And maybe I could explain that a little bit, too. When a fishery is an open fishery, anyone can fish that. Someone from Ohio, Washington State, anybody from Alaska, anybody has a boat. Under the federal constitution and state constitution, as much as we maybe want to see it differently, equal protection applies to all Americans. So anybody can be in any fishery they want if they so choose, if it's open. When we decide that a fishery needs to be closed, we are, as Dale said, trying to award permits to people who have a history in that fishery. That may not be the optimum number of permits. That's the optimum number study that is supposed to come later. But we issue permits to everybody in that fishery so they can continue to make a livelihood in that fishery. But as a fishery starts to become more stressed and there's less fish for the fishermen and they have to close the season more, that means that fishermen, which is a very difficult job out there, if you might be aware, I don't need to go to all the details of that, but it's a very difficult business. And all of us that have been involved in it know that mechanically, hydraulics, refrigeration, everything that goes along with being a fisherman, and every one of them is an independent businessman, they have to make enough money in order to stay out there. And if there's too many fishermen in the fishery, then all the fishermen suffer. So when we do an optimum number study, we may bring it down to a number of permits in a fishery that allow for each fisherman to make a living so they can stay out there. Because I myself love scallops and king crab, but I don't know how to catch them, and even if I did, I wouldn't want to go out in the Bering Sea and do it, but I'm glad there are people who go out there and catch that and bring it back to us, including all the wonderful seafood we have in Alaska. We have, of course, the world's best seafood, and it's partly because of the management of our fisheries that we implemented, as you mentioned at the beginning, through the constitutional amendments and the limiting of our fisheries. And that's basically what an optimum study would do. It would create a buyback system. A way a buyback system works is the last one we had, the federal government gave us a $65 million loan that then we used to, the fishermen used to tax themselves to pay back the loan. So the fishermen voluntarily paid money back to the federal government, and they reduced the number of fishermen in the fishery voluntarily, so that some fishermen decided to get out of the fishery, sell off their permit back to the CFEC, then we just extinguished the permit down to the optimum numbers. And that's basically how a buyback would work.
Other questions?
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Meyer. So, Mr. Putman, as you mentioned, when the fishing is closed, then you issue the permits. Mm-hmm. And do we have any idea, are most of these permit holders Alaska residents or outside Alaska, and what would be the ratio?
The current ratio is about 77% Alaskan. So that would be 23% out of state. But the when you have transferable permits that are saleable on the open market, there is no limitation on who that person can sell it to. So a permit that's transferable can be sold to anyone anywhere in the United States. So there's no way to stop that from happening. But I can say at the initial outset, our goal is enough. I don't want to get into the statutes and regulations, but basically the way they're designed is to benefit the people who depend on the fishery the most, who have a history of depending on the fishery and don't have other outside sources of income, like a teacher that comes there in the summer and fishes and stuff like that. People who live in a village or a town or small town in Alaska where the fishing is the main source of income are the people that really get the valuable permit, the transferable permit. And I think the intent of the legislature at that time was that those permits would be retained in the village or the town in which they live. And about 50% of our permits are actually transferred without cost to other people through estates or through gifting, and about 50% are sold. Oftentimes they're sold, and that's sometimes how the out-migration of permits can happen to the lower 48 people.
Okay, very good, Mr. Chairman, if I may. So when the permits are sold, any idea what they go for?
Sure. Yeah. Again, our economists do this regularly because our fees are based on the price of the value of the permit. So we know exactly how much each permit is worth in each fishery. It's all posted on our website if you're interested in looking at that. To give you an idea, a Bristol Bay drift permit, which are the most valuable, are about $220,000 per permit. There's about 1,600 of those in existence. Bristol Bay, or a Setnet permit on the east side of Cook Inlet, which is also a piece of legislation that you might have before you, those are worth somewhere in the neighborhood of about $25,000 for a Setnet permit. So that doesn't involve equipment and boats and things like that. So that's, I think I have those numbers right, but of course I'm always hoping for corrections if I'm wrong. And maybe Dale could straighten me out.
Thank you. Do you want to chime in on that, Dale?
Not really. There's so many permits in the state, and they every month the permit value changes. So as Faith said, they're published. The commission publishes a report on the permit value. Just depends on what the fishing season was and kind of the long-term outlook for the fishery. So we can look something up if you'd like to know.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? One for me, and this is for Dale. I noticed you worked with UFA, and you were on their board. Did you have to go off the board to get onto this?
Until March 1st, I was the longest-seated UFA board member.
Is that right?
I've chaired UFA.
So this has messed that up, huh?
It kind of has, and I can't take back my lifetime membership, though. I mean, you have to understand that, but I've told them that I am not doing any UFA business other than whatever they bring in front of the commission that they'd like to talk to us about or generate research from. I backed off all my policy in industry, my policy work as of March 1st. The only thing that I have done is asked for a ruling on one of the international commissions I'm on. I've asked to stay on the North, we've asked for an ethics the determination on whether or not I can stay on the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission just because it's super light duty. It's a commission that has a lot of meaning, personal meaning, not just my business meaning. And if they say that that's a problem, I'll resign from that too. But I've been backing off everything.
Well, just from what I read and looking at the job of the commission, you're number one, well suited. But you have had your hand in many, many fisheries. There's no doubt about it. And the management of the fisheries in Alaska has probably unique challenges, but it's also got a pretty good reputation.
It sure does.
And for that, I'd like to see us keep that going into the end of the 21st century, you know, and because there are some that have literally blasted their fisheries totally out. So far so good. But it's a fight. I know that there are many fights to be had yet.
That's right.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I got into fish first, for fish first, not for fishermen or fisheries. I'm with you, and I care a lot about it. And because I have represented fishermen in many arenas and all around the country, I'm really proud of our system. You know, Fish and Game does a tremendous job. Board of Fish, our council up here is far and away one of the best in the nation. I'm proud to be part of that. Coming from the industry perspective, and this was just another way from where I'm coming from to help represent that industry and the state in just kind of a different angle, but exactly the same bottom line goal.
Well, as kind of the appellate court, you get to be where the buck stops in many ways for a good portion of them, those that will go to the Superior Court. So then that brings up a question on when you do make a decision that, say, is remanded back to you from the Superior Court, do you then have to answer that question? Does that become your precedent, or is it just a one-time ruling only because they're so unique? I just don't understand enough about it, obviously, to know once that happens, how do you guys obviously, as some have gone to the Supreme Court, so do you guys end up establishing a rule that that the commission generally looks at, and the anomalies are go to the court, or does the court look at your prior precedent? Just curious.
Maybe I should maybe take that one.
I'm going to point to the attorney of the team because I think he's better suited to. It's a great question.
Yeah, all all of our cases, all 70 of our cases, gone to Supreme Court, and then the hundreds that have gone to Superior Court set precedent for the commission. So we have to follow the precedent that the court has laid down for us. And so I think I can't say this for a fact, but I think the 13 cases that are still pending in the commission that have been there for 20 and 30 and 40 years, some of them, are the most difficult cases that, in fact, if we don't get them exactly right, may bring the whole system, like that thread of out of a sweater, coming apart. So we have to be very cautious of what we do. The two cases that we've handled on remand back from the Superior Court were cases that were brought to the Superior Court on appeal by a fisherman. The fisherman convinced the Superior Court that we may have made a mistake, and those cases get remanded back to us for a second review. The two that I've dealt with, we sent our decisions back to the Superior Court, and we actually were able to settle those two cases based on the negotiations with the party. I will say the Attorney General is actually our real lawyers. They are the ones that give us real legal advice. You don't have to be an attorney to serve on this commission. It helps, but certainly we have the backup of the Attorney General's office when we make these kind of decisions. They know all the cases, and of course before Dale and I make any decisions, we want to know all the cases too. So we've got our work cut out for us. And I do want to point out for you also, you'll notice in our annual report, it's going to look very different than annual reports in the past. This annual report's only 5 pages long. They've been up to 70 pages in the past. So we've got a 5-page report. On the back side of the report will be appendixes that if you're really interested, you can dive into the details of each one of these sections. But there's 4 sections. There are 5 pages that you can deal with. We'd love to come back and give you an overview of that annual report in the future. But just for things to think about, there are 2 mandates that the legislature gave us back in 1975 in the enabling statute. One of them is to regulate fisheries and to determine how many permits are in a fishery, but also the optimum number question. That's one of the mandates. The other is recommendations to you for future legislation to improve the regulation of commercial fishing in Alaska. So that's something we're studying right now. We'll have some recommendations for you when we finish our annual report. I could tell you about them now, but I don't think maybe this is the time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I look forward to it. Other questions? Thank you. And we didn't have anybody sign up for public testimony, so and this is unusual, having anything to do with fish and have no public testimony. Very unusual indeed. With that, I'm going to just say thank you. I'm going to read the statement that's going to move your name on to the full body for recommendation, and we'll sign it. So in accordance with the Alaska Statute 3905.080, the Resource Committee reviewed the following recommendations, the appointments before to the joint session for consideration. Dale Kelly and Vance. Oh, I didn't know. Vance, Fate Putman. That's nice to know. So this doesn't reflect the intent of any members to vote for or against the confirmation during further sessions, but we'll forward it on to the full body. Thank you very much. Very, very informative, and thank you for your service. Both of you appreciate it very much. Thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease, Ann. Back to order, Ann. Just to adjourn the Resource Committee and keep your ears open for the next agenda, which I don't have in front of me right now. We're adjourned.